Welcome to the first in the series of conversations from Cassettes and Chocolate Milk. This is an interview with bassist and vocalist Colin Swan from the highly influential Battersea Mod Revival group, The Direct Hits. If you're unfamiliar with the three-piece, the band released their first single, Modesty Blaze, on Dan Treacy's Wham Records in 1982. They would come to achieve widespread acclaim and critical recognition with their debut album, Blow Up, released in the autumn of 1984. 2 years later, the band would turn neo-psychedelic with their second LP, The House of Secrets. The Direct Hits also had a considerable legion of fans both in the UK and in Germany, and they are also credited as having the longest-running fanzine, The Direct Hits Monthly. Although the band called it quits in 1987, the songwriting efforts of Colin Swan and Gino Buckmaster are still widely revered by fans and collectors alike. In more recent times, Colin has reworked both albums, Blow Up and The House of Secrets, incorporating previously unissued tracks, remixes and rare alternative versions. At present, he's working on the Great British Beat compilation, which features some more unreleased compositions from Buckmaster and Swan. I hope you enjoy the first in the series of conversations, and if you enjoy what you hear, please visit the official site of Direct Hits at thedirecthits.co.uk.
Age free girls, every modesty blaze would you. Read her exploits in her daily papers in blue. She's saving lives while I'm eating cornflakes. What a
I was just wondering if you've been surprised by the revived interest in Direct Hits.
Yeah, well, of course we have, really, yeah. I mean, it really started through the Diane bringing the website to life, because there was quite a lot of stuff on the internet asking what happened to the band. So I think she just followed that up, and then, there was quite a lot of email come through about that, so it was all good, yeah.
That's fantastic. Oh, well, I'm really glad that both yourself and Diane have decided to speak to your fans and your audience and, you know, at least bring out this revised Blow Up. How did it feel working on these songs again with your son, Philip?
Yeah, it was great, because obviously I was, as he says in the liner notes, I was never that happy with a finished record, so it always sounded a little bit thin, sounded a little bit empty to me, so I've always wanted to go back here for some time, and obviously, he's grown up with the stuff and he knew it pretty well, so it was good to get him involved and just try and recreate the bits and pieces that were missing. And there was a lot of stuff there which I didn't even realise was on the master tracks, some stuff that we mixed out, well, I could find anyway, vocals and stuff that were not included. So it was really good, yeah.
Did you have any concerns about remaining faithful to the original mixes? Or?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, that's a main concern, really. But it's quite sort of mono sounding. So my idea was to just bring a bit left and right, so to give it some space, some headroom, because it did sound a little bit small.
Yeah, yeah, I get what you, yeah. Well, I really enjoyed what you did with Aleister Crowley specifically. I think it was, you know, you brought in a lot of ambience, and you know, I Never Really Played Things sounded a lot bigger and richer. And so it was interesting. Although My Back Pages kind of shocked me a little bit, I have to say. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think we just set out to complement it rather than try and recreate a better version as such. I think it's just some stuff that I wanted to. To put back in, and I mean, I did ask Gino to do some stuff on it, but he's a musical influence, a quite sort of definite, like he is. He's always been about everything.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When he gets into something, he really gets into it.
So, how did he feel when you proposed that you were going to be reworking on these tracks again?
Well, yeah, I mean, I offered him to come to the studio and do some stuff, but he sort of because he's got into this pre-war blues.
Yeah.
She's got into about, it must be 10 years ago, he didn't feel as though he could contribute anything to it, so he was quite happy for us to do it, and he really liked the finished version, so
yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a bit like yours. I had to play it to him first before I let it go.
Well, it's a bit difficult if you know, you're so used to the original versions to sort of,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and for everyone, really, yeah. But yeah. The feedback has been really good.
No, it's fantastic. I've been listening to it so much lately, so yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
That's good.
She keeps me locked away to use another day amongst the toys and broken doors. She wants to buy another. Satisfied with all the power that she holds. Well, now let me tell you things that you can't see. I am not in slavery, and I don't got a battery. I cannot supply your everything. I'm not your ever-ready plaything.
How did you and Gino collaborate creatively?
Well, the way we used to do it was I would go away and come up with some songs, and then he would have a few, and then we kind of collaborate. That's how we started off doing it. I think on Blow Up, we did write a lot of stuff together. He sort of wrote War in the Middle Eights, and I did some stuff on Henry Unhappy Inventor. That was his own song.
Yeah.
And then I added the longer bits, and then he added a bit more. So, yeah, it was pretty much, collaboration on that early stuff.
Like you bring in a bit, I bring in a bit, kind of a...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I used to, one or two songs I'd complete, I think, My Back Pages I probably had complete, I think, Everybody Play Thing, I think that was his kind of thing, which is why he sings that.
Yeah.
It's quite rare, really, but it doesn't do many lead vocals, but I think when we recorded that, it was just pitched too high, I couldn't do it, so that was how he comes to do the lead vocal. But, yeah, it was mainly that. I think, you can pick out your songs, I think they're fairly sort of, they're quite a bit different to what mainly mine, but...
I was curious about that. Like, are there specific Buckmaster hallmarks or Swan hallmarks that you can tell,
Well, I think his songs tend to have less minor chords in them. They tend to be a bit more, I suppose they're a bit more Who-like. They're a bit more kind of harder-edged, I would say. Some minor, more acoustic songs, I guess. And apart from, there was one that we left off of Blow Up, which was that song that he brought in to the studio and he did on his own with an acoustic guitar, that track.
Was that the one that he did by himself, the Start Living?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, he just brought that in and then he brought in, there is another one actually that we added quite a lot of stuff to because it was only a basic acoustic guitar and him singing. What is that called? I can't remember the library, what it's called.
Captivating Eyes, maybe, or...?
Yeah, that's it, Captivating Eyes.
Right.
Yeah, he had a few working titles for that. But, we actually, he abandoned that at the time, and it was only when I found the tape box, that I thought it was quite good, and that's when we added all the stuff to it, because there was nothing of it, just him and an acoustic guitar.
Yeah, I get the impression, at least from the liner notes, that there was quite a few things that Gino didn't like, so that were scrapped. Was that sort of the trend, or...?
No, I mean, he tended to leave, I mean, he did leave quite a lot of that stuff to me, or I think things like song choices, he pretty much came in and then we'd decide what we was going to put on it, and then sometimes I would go back to it afterwards and redo my bass parts, or, because I read that was how McCartney did it, he went back at Beatles songs and did the bass tracks on his own,
after
he'd already recorded them,
and
I found that really good. I always just take influences like that and think, well, how did they do it to make it so good? So I tried to do that.
And now,
Henry's dead, Henry's gone, blown to smithereens. In his room, all alone, Henry's only dreaming. Going to do with my life.
words can't replace.
Second album, House of Secrets, we got really into that stuff, you know, tried to remake Revolver. I think we just and we had Dave Goodman, who was Sex Pistols producer, and their really early stuff, you know, before they got signed.
Yeah.
He did that. He produced that, and he was great, you know, because he was into all that when sitar and stuff and backward guitars.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about House of Secrets, because seems to that you don't think of it, I don't know if this is perhaps a little bit presumptuous, but you don't think of it as warmly as you do Blow Up?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I think, because that was, it was 2 years before it came out after Blow Up, and for a few years after that, I didn't think it was quite as good. Some people were, I think some of the reviews were not quite as good, and you know, I kind of dismissed that. But afterwards, I think that sounds a bit more rounded to me. That, and we went on tour halfway through making that, which is why I think that side two sounds more dynamic than side one, because I think we've been playing a lot of one-nighters and we've got better as a band. So.
Right.
And then we come back and did the second side. It was that's sort of pre-announced. And I like that because there is lots of different ideas on that.
Yeah, I noticed also on the second album there was a lot less sort of character portrait songs.
Yeah, well, we'd been, I guess we'd had those songs quite a while, like any band. You know, your first flush of songs, you play them live quite a lot, so we were pretty well versed in those songs. And I think when you come to the second one, you know, if you get a shot at doing a second one, which is quite rare, really, for most bands now. But we just tried to make it a bit of a departure. But, yeah, I mean, those songs have been around for... We've been gigging those songs for 4 years, maybe five right. years before we recorded them. So it's always, you know, you go in and you know what you're doing.
Yeah. So you decided to sort of have a departure from that type of imagery. And would you say sort of the latest songs are more autobiographical, would you say, or...?
I would say there's more melody in them.
Right.
They're a bit more melodic. They sound a bit more melodic to me. And also I see that as, that's kind of when we kind of went from that black and white thing with Blow Up, where it was a more mod-influenced stuff. And then House of Secrets, we kind of, by that time, we got into slightly kind of psychedelic thing.
Just how easy it would be to fall in love. No education's necessary. Here it comes now. And love is just like an abacus. It's as simple as an abacus. Love is just like an abacus. Just like an abacus, yeah. It's as simple as an abacus. Love is just like an abacus. And it all adds up to me. What can I do when she only wants to be with me? She sings the list constantly. 1, 2, 3, 4 beats. Show me how easy love could be, yeah. And love is just like an abacus. Just like an abacus. Like an abacus, yeah. 2, 3, 4.
about Dan when we first met him. You know, we went to his flat in the King's Road. He had a great flat in the King's Road, and he was, when we went to meet him and play him our stuff, he was painting those album covers.
Yeah.
And I think we kind of joined in, and we just thought it was, you know, he really seemed really childlike to us.
Yeah.
So, you know, but he was great because he showed a bit of faith in us, and he wanted to release Monty Blaze, and that's how we got on the Wham thing, and then we got on those tours because of doing those tours of Germany because of that, which is great, you know.
Yeah. Did you find that Dan had a bit of an influence in terms of, you know, introducing that more of a psychedelic influence?
Yeah, he definitely did. I mean, we got us a couple of gigs as well. I think we did the Coal Hole in the Strand in town. I think we did that, and I think they were on the bill, and I think it was Doctor and the Medics and maybe the Marble Staircase, something like that. But we were kind of struggling a bit with that crowd because we didn't, you know. Well, I thought that was really good. I remember Dan using the spray can.
Yeah.
On the backdrop, and I can remember the management getting really uptight because it was going everywhere. And but yeah, that was all good fun, that.
Yeah. I get a great kick out of reading a lot of the anecdotes on your website, and, you know, in the liner notes in particular, like stories like the Dr. Ben sort of anecdote of losing his contact lenses halfway through a song.
You know,
do you have a particularly favourite song or anecdote?
Well, I mean, all drummers that I've come across, in fact, all drummers that I've ever had in bands that were subsequent to the Burrowed Hicks, like this Happy Breed,
yeah,
and whatever I've done since, all drummers seem to be, they've got some kind of neurosis. They're just failed musicians. Or whether they just feel the need to go. I mean, you know, Brian Grover, a perfect example. You know, he whenever he went anywhere, you would always have to put the lid on him because no matter if he was doing interviews, he'd always say the wrong thing. Whatever he said was wrong.
Oh my goodness!
And there was it was just like that. You know, he used to drink the most, he used to take the most pills, stuff like that. You know, he was uncontrollable. All drummers seem to have some setback, and that Dr. Ben that we had, he was as a junior doctor, you know, he was probably the worst person to dabble in all that, but he was pretty out of control. But his lens falling out was always happening. That's why he had to go, really.
Yeah. Well, it seemed like you had a terrible run with drummers, you know, whoever you were dealing with.
Yeah, we had a terrible run with drummers. Yeah. You know, in fact, Brian Grover wasn't the first choice, really. To be honest, he just looked great, you know, he just looked really good. He turned up for an audition and he had a really great Beware cut and he had a Target T-shirt and he was really good. He wrecked all the kit and he regularly used to break drumsticks. I mean, I don't know any drummers since who broke maybe three pairs of drumsticks in one gig. And in the end, we got him really heavy-duty, big drumsticks, but he would still break them. You know, he just hit everything so hard, you know. I think I've still got a bit of hearing problem because of his cymbals.
Oh, my goodness. But you recorded the second album with him, so he was probably the longest staying.
Yeah, I mean, by then he was a lot more kind of, he didn't want to go on tour, first of all. He became a bit, had a bit of a phobia about it. He didn't want to, and then after we finished going to Germany, he didn't want to come back. He wanted to stay there then. He decided that he was going to stay in Berlin because that was the place to be. So once he got a taste for it, he was off and running with it. But yeah, he got better during the recording of the second album. I don't think he was technically that good. There were some songs, in fact, that we couldn't play live because I think everybody played him. We never ever played that live because he couldn't produce that beat successfully. So
right.
That's how kind of, if I went back in now, I would get a drummer who's a bit more able. But he was great because he looked great and he was good fun. So.
Great, it's big for any even girl.
Do you find that you have to be a bit diplomatic in recalling these stories?
There's lots of stuff that went on. When we went on those tours, it was pretty wild, really. I felt like anyone would, because up to that time, I don't think any of us had been out of the UK. So the first time, 25 years old, I think, when you go, I'd never seen anything like that. We went to Germany, I'd never seen a red light district or...
Yeah.
We are in England, we're pretty repressed over here, we were then.
So what happened in Germany?
Loads of stuff, really. You don't want to hurt anyone because, we're all married now. But no, it's just like any band would do, it was good time, really. It was a good time. The way they looked after a band there, as opposed to touring here, we did a lot of one-nighters down the country, but in provincial England. But when you got over there, they would lay everything on. We wasn't used to that.
Yeah.
When you get to a place, they would ask you what you want. We never had any kind of riders with gigs before.
Yeah.
But they were great because they supplied everything you could want, and of course they're very good at managing dates and times. I made sure that everyone got up and got out. So, I remember, Berlin, I think that gig in Berlin, I think the one in Hamburg, that was as good as it gets, I think. Apart from the things like the Mod Aid All Day that we did in Walthamstow, I think that was the last time we probably played together.
Yeah, in 86?
Yeah.
At the Town Hall, Yeah,
I think we put that together just... I think that was the last one we did probably... That's how I remember it ended anyway. I remember coming back off the last tour we did was about 87. When I got back, I remember thinking that was it, more or less.
Yeah, it was really...
I didn't do too much after that.
What happened? I'm really confused about how it all just fell apart.
Well, I think, if you look at the history of the Mod Revival, I think what happened was it turned kind of scooterist. There was all these rallies going on, but I think it had got more insular. It was a bit more sort of... It was more scooter boys. It almost kind of it became a biker thing, I think.
Mm.
And then with that, all the kind of movement that went with it, which is a lot bigger than I thought, actually. Because, now, obviously, if you had the internet and you had the possibilities that Facebook gives you, you'd have been able to put the piece together all these movements a lot better. Because, all I had, really, was this newsletter thing that went up and down the country, which is that Phoenix Society thing.
Yeah.
And they told everyone what was on, but really, now it would have been so much more easy to communicate. And I think, would that have made it better? I don't know.
So was it a sort of an alienation from the movement, or...?
Well, I just remember that coming to an end without... it gets a bit mixed up because it was kind of a couple of endings to it, really. And then after that last Mod Aid gig, I think... I remember thinking then that we'd kind of outgrown it. There was very young kids as well, and I think when I got to about 25, 26, I started to think, I can't really pull this off with that same kind of, it just seemed to be different. There
right.
was very young kids at that gig, I think. And there was other bands coming up as well who were kind of behind us. Because we did okay, there wasn't any great... I don't know what these bands are called, and that did in Small World, they did maybe a bit better than us. I don't know what kind of following they've got now. I don't know whether there's as many people who are interested in it. I don't know what kind of feedback they still get. I think some of them have been doing gigs recently. I don't know about that. Maybe somewhere in town, I think I saw a couple of gigs on, but... Yeah, I remember it coming to a halt, I just remember thinking that was it around about that time.
Thank you.
you know, there was quite a lot of, you know, as we started to go up north and play those gigs, you know, I think even then I was amazed at how many people knew your stuff. And then, you know, we covered quite a lot of ground, really. We went to Belfast to play. And so a lot of bands wouldn't go to Belfast. You know, I remember when we went, which was 85, I think, some bands were saying, oh, you know, you shouldn't go there because it's far too risky. But we went there, and the most risky thing was the plane.
The plane?
The plane was like 6 feet held together with sellotape. And I remember going there, and when we got there, it was really good. I mean, you know, we had quite a lot of fans there, and it was the most biggest crowd I'd seen. I don't think it couldn't have sounded very good, because the place we played in was a massive big hall, and we was using their support band's equipment, the back line, and it just must have sounded horrendous. But because it was, you know, both Catholic and Protestant kids could come together there.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a neutral. So you got a lot of kids turn up, you know, and it was really good. You couldn't get out of there. It got quite anarchic at the end, you know.
Yeah.
There were loads of people with the records and stuff, and we signed loads of records. And I just remember thinking, this is the nearest I'll ever get to being famous.
Oh, well, that's so nice. But I think that must have been a gratitude that you came as well, you know, because so often with, you know, cities people don't venture out.
Yeah. And now that's what they said, you know. We kind of a little chat with a lot of people before the gig, and we had to get away pretty quick from that gig, actually, because I think the next day was the Walthamstow Mod Aid one, I think, and we was on pretty early at that gig, and I think we had to get back to get over to Walthamstow to set some gear up, and you had to be there at a certain time for that, I think. And I think I can't even remember whether we actually made the flight. I think we missed one, and we had to wait for a while, because it was that. And then, of course, you kept getting stopped by the military police, who insisted you own the guitar case every 15 minutes.
Right.
And then we had to walk away from the concert because you couldn't drive the van there. I mean, you know, it was quite touch and go, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, yes, apart from never seeing the police with guns on the streets, it wasn't that much, you know, it wasn't that much different to any mainstream gig.
I don't know if I would have done it, but anyway...
Yeah. But
you must have had some awareness of how big you were, you know, with the Direct Hits Monthly and that being one of the most successful fanzines.
Yeah, that was good, yeah, because, well, I mean, you know, that's all down to Diane, because she just approached us really early on and said, you know, I'd like to do this fanzine, and everyone was doing that fanzine stuff at the time. It was all handwritten, and it was all Xeroxed and sent out, and then we kind of lost a bit of involvement, and she used to turn up, do photo sessions, and then... she would do all that stuff, and the next thing it kind of all gone out, and it built up a lot bigger than I thought, and it ran for ages and ages.
Yeah.
After we kind of, I think she kept going as long as was physically possible, really, without much input from us. But yeah, I mean, there was a load of interest in that. Yeah, in fact, I've seen some people trying to buy them now, and I can't imagine why, because I mean, it was pretty basic, really.
You wouldn't want to put together a compendium, like put all the 30 issues together into a book or something? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you there might be quite a lot of people like the band, but they're so spread apart that you'd have to have a world convention to make it worthwhile, probably, wouldn't you? I don't know. I've really got no idea how many, you know, how many people know that stuff still, or how, you know, how much interest there is in it still.
I don't know. I think it'd be worthwhile, definitely. I mean, like, judging from the interest in the revisited, you know, albums and...
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty unexpected, really. There was a lot of interest in that. And there was, I mean, I did see that there was quite a few, there was piles of letters that used to come through. And we did have, quite a lot of interest. That probably did help us as a band. I think our other bands did some other bands did a similar sort of thing. But I think the fact that we kept it going so long is the thing that makes it, you know, mildly interesting. It's a bit like a diary, and sometimes I look at that stuff and I think, you know, it is like a diary of that whole period, you know, day to day, running diary, which is, you know, it's great to have, really.
is a little girl who waits for me religiously while I jot down all the things she says on my back page is silent by her bedside, no mistaking her. Nightmares keep waking up while I jot down all the things she says on my back page is a chance of sleep has long since gone with last month's wages. Driving about to tell her that I love her. She's going faster than I ever, ever could have dreamed. Much too much is heaven, but the lonely little girl who sits and waits for me will surely see the hurt and pain that I describe on my back pages. Silent by her bedside, no mistaking her. Nightmares keep waking her while I jot down all the things she says on my back pages. The chance of sleep has long since gone with last month's wages. But I've no time to tell her that I love her. She's growing faster than I ever could have dreamed. Much too much has happened, but the lonely little girl who sits and waits for me.
Just to satisfy my curiosity, was My Back Pages about a kid or a girlfriend? I've just always wondered about that.
I think it was probably a girlfriend, I think.
Right.
Probably quite a few. There's quite a few contributing factors to it, really. But, yeah, I mean, it's... I don't know. It probably remains one of my favourite songs, I guess, because it's pretty simple. And I think it probably all came all at once, you know. I seem to remember it coming all at once, that song. Sometimes you get bits of songs I used to write from titles. Sometimes I'd find titles and like Multi Blows, I think that was like that.
Mm.
And that's all about the bus riding in front of my flats and stuff like that, you know. You just look around you and write about what you see, you know, how some of the best songs are constructed, so...
Yeah, I get that sort of observation about it.
Yeah, which I think is in something like Place in the 80s, I think that was constructed of kitchen sink dramas.
Absolutely. You know, I've probably said this just a couple of moments ago, but just reading the stories behind the songs, it's just such a rare thing to get that sort of insight behind the stories. And
I hadn't really thought about that until recently. And, you know, quite a few people have asked us about that, you know, that stuff and how you write those songs. And I think it does make you think, you know, where did they come from? And then if I look at them, it comes back to me, you know, some stuff from it. You remember... parts of it. I've had various people in Germany, there was loads of people, they were really interested in how that worked. You know, I must have answered 100 questions about what that's about.
You
know, need
an FAQ.
Is that a pro Alex Crowley song, or and I think I maybe got most of it from a book. I think it's in that, the liner notes about, there was a paperback book about him.
About Aleister Crowley, are you saying?
Yeah, and I thought I just read some of that stuff, and most of it went into that song.
I love how you said it. It was like, you were so disappointed that you picked such a loser for a
mascot. It wasn't a good hero to have, really. I mean, there's loads of others I could have come up with. But it's almost a good song. It's just a good song topic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Always looking for, I suppose,
Yeah, well, I was very intrigued by Henry the Unhappy Inventor and the sort of... It was such an epic song for that era.
We used to play that live. And in fact, that 100 Club footage, that's also all there. I think the bits on YouTube is only a warm-up. I think there is 12 songs on that video. And it ends up with the live version we used to do of Henry the Unhappy Inventor. And we used to get lost in that in the middle. Because that's lots of different songs put together, really. I think, some of it is my song. I did have a song, I think, which I put together and we took most of the lyrics out. It was Gino's idea. And he did some, there were some drawings for it as well. He did like a cartoon, because it's quite good like that. You know, we both used to draw a bit. And he did some illustrations for that. I don't know what happened to that either. It was like a little story.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did some stuff for that. I think that may be in one of the various monthlies.
Yeah, this needs to get out. This is important. You've got to get this out.
Yeah, I guess, so it seems to be, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, and it's that mystery of what happens at the end of the song as well, you know, knocking on the door, what happened to
him. Yeah, that's right. And we did have an end piece of that, which is that bit I'll revive, because all I found for that was words, just lyrics that we had for a little ending that we didn't use. And, yeah, I mean, that's what I try to finish off, you know, because you like to finish off things.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, well, I'm really pleased that there's so much interest in it.
No, it's fantastic. I'm really appreciative. Yeah. I got the opportunity to talk to you after so many years of liking your music.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm really glad. Thank you so much, Colin.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, all the best.
Thank you. Bye.